The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Today we got the news that Donald Trump's one criminal case that was likely to go to trial before the November election may be delayed. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's hush money case was set to go to trial on March 25th, less than 2 weeks from today. But now that date is in question. Now, Trump's legal strategy in all of his cases has been to push them off as long as possible, preferably till the month of February. But today's delay is not coming from Trump, or at least not directly. Today, D.A. Bragg's office consented to a 30-day delay in the start of the trial, but not because D.A. Bragg needs another month. The issue at hand is a new trove of records that were turned over by the feds, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. Tens of thousands of records. Specifically, 31,000 pages of records that the U.S. Attorney's Office just handed over to Bragg's office yesterday. Now, the DA specifically pins this newest delay on Trump, saying that Trump's legal team waited until just 2 months ago to request this massive trove of records from the U.S. Attorney's Office. And don't get me wrong, I am sure Trump's legal team is using every opportunity that exists to create delays in this case. It is what they do. But D.A. Bragg's office and the U.S. Attorney's office know that. And one of the reasons this appears to be happening so late in the game is because the U.S. Attorney's office requested repeated extensions that Trump's side consented to, according to D.A. Bragg. When the New York Times asked the U.S. Attorney's office for comment on the delay, the office declined to respond. Now, the fact that this latest delay might be the responsibility of an arm of the Justice Department would be a big deal on its own. But this case is not alone. This delay would seem to fit a pattern. Just hours after Merrick Garland was sworn in as Attorney General, he held a private briefing to get up to speed on what he promised was his highest priority, bringing to justice the people responsible for January 6th. But then, more than a year passed. Witnesses in the fake electors scheme told the Washington Post that they assumed the case was dead because no one at the DOJ was contacting them. Remember Trump's infamous call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, the call where Trump pressured Raffensperger to find him 11,000 votes? Well, key witnesses to that call in early 2021 told the Washington Post that no one at the FBI contacted them until 2023, 2 years after the fact. What was happening at the Department of Justice in that time? Well, thanks to great reporting from the Washington Post, we know that the answer to that question is not much. There were internal debates and heated arguments over this choice, but for more than a year, the Justice Department policy was to go after the little guys and work their way up. As one former Justice Department official told the Post, you couldn't use the T word. Meaning you couldn't mention Trump. The way the Washington Post reports it, the Department of Justice was so worried about looking like they were prosecuting Donald Trump for political reasons that they gave Trump treatment no other defendant in America would get. They effectively ignored him, despite the fact that he was at the very center of this plot. It wasn't until intrepid reporting and the House January 6th committee started unearthing troves of evidence implicating Trump and his top aides in the January 6th riot, which, duh, it wasn't until all of that started coming out publicly that the Justice Department actually began investigating Trump in earnest. Ultimately, the FBI didn't open an investigation into Trump, the guy at the beating heart of everything, until 15 months after the Capitol attack. Key witnesses in the meantime may have forgotten specifics or deleted emails. And it also set the actual prosecution of this case back more than a year. And now the window of time in which that case could make it to trial before the November election is so small, it seems nearly impossible that the American public will get a ruling before they have to vote for president. We saw a similar delay coming from the Department of Justice in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. Remember that form that Trump's lawyers signed on his behalf in June of 2022? It claimed that Trump's legal team had performed a diligent search and had turned over all of the classified documents in Trump's possession. Well, thanks yet again to extensive reporting in the Washington Post, we know that it is almost, that point is almost where the entire classified documents investigation ended. It turns out there was a months-long fight between prosecutors who had evidence suggesting that Trump and his lawyers might not be telling the whole truth, prosecutors who wanted to search Mar-a-Lago, and the FBI. The FBI wanted to take Trump and his lawyers at their word. They did not want to touch Donald Trump. The optics were too controversial. That infighting delayed the actual search of Mar-a-Lago for months. And of course, when Mar-a-Lago was ultimately searched, FBI agents found more than 100 classified documents, 18 of them top secret. By the fall of 2022, prosecutors were reportedly ready to charge Trump based on what they had found. It looked like a fairly straightforward case. But they did not charge Trump. Before they could, Trump announced that he was running for re-election. And the calculations within the Department of Justice changed. Once again, the department deferred to Trump and his political realities. To avoid anything that might even look like political prosecution, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Jack Smith as special counsel. Now, Smith worked really quite quickly, but ultimately he didn't charge Trump until June of the following year. That set back the prosecution timeline another 8 months. Now, the classified documents case is currently scheduled to go on trial on May 20th, but that date is widely expected to be bumped back, potentially delaying that trial just past the November election and missing that key date by a matter of months. After being delayed for nearly a year by, yes, Judge Aileen Cannon, but also indecision, infighting, and the passing of the case to a special counsel at the Department of Justice.
Do you, looking back now, do you think that the department took too long to bring these cases, maybe?
Special prosecutors followed the facts and the law. They brought cases when they thought they were ready.
So we already know that one of the reasons Trump might not face accountability before the election in either of his federal criminal cases is because the Department of Justice dragged its feet and fought internally and was cautious to a fault. But now tonight, we learned that even in a state-level prosecution, in D.A. Bragg's New York State hush money case, the most likely case to see trial before the November election, even in that case, it looks like the Justice Department may be playing a very real role in delaying justice. Joining me now are former FBI General Counsel Andrew Weissman and NYU Law Professor Melissa Murray. Together, they are the authors of the brand new number one, not bad guys, New York Times bestseller, The Trump Indictments, The Historic Charging Documents with Commentary. Congratulations on this.
Thank you.
It's not the holidays, but it's not too early to buy copies for every person in your family. We'll talk more about that in a second. I first, Andrew, have to get your opinion on what's happened here in the New York hush money case, because on the outside, yes, I understand Trump's doing everything he can to delay, but what's going on here with the Department of Justice and their ability to get the DA and the defendants the documents they need in a timely fashion?
So self-inflicted wound, it doesn't look good, especially when we're about to get a decision on DA Fannie Willis. Even if there's a decision not to disqualify her, the combination looks really poor. At the very least, this is a massive screw up on the part of the Southern District of New York prosecutors. I mean, really poor judgment not to have turned everything over a year ago when the DA's office asked for this information. If you've got inculpatory information, you should turn that over. If you've got exculpatory information that could help the defendant, you need to turn that over. So it was just a bad decision. I'm very focused not on sort of, you know, this isn't going to be fatal to the case. There will be a trial. I'm very focused on what the information is. One thing to note is that the DA's submission today said that there's still more to come. So it's worth knowing they do not yet know, neither side, not the DA nor the defense knows exactly what the full scope is. I think that there could be information that's additional bad acts by Michael Cohen. Remember, Michael Cohen had pled guilty there, and the Southern District of New York prosecutors had publicly said at the plea hearing how much they distrusted him. They were very much fighting with our office, the special counsel's office. We were saying he should get credit. They were saying, no, he shouldn't. So there could be more information about that. There could be more information about Alan Weisselberg, because reading the tea leaves, it appears that Alan Weisselberg may have given information to them, may have even testified in the grand jury, but may have lied.
And he has already pled guilty to perjury. So.
Exactly. But there could be just more complications there. There also could be discussions about the theory of the case of the federal campaign violation case. Why do I say that? Because if you remember, let's go back in the time machine to when Bill Barr was the attorney general and was fighting with the acting U.S. attorney, Audrey Strauss, saying that you should essentially get rid of the case, and she pushed back. So there could just be a whole massive material, and that's what I'm sort of keeping my eye on, is sort of like, what is the information, and is it going to be something that's really, you know, meaningful? Exactly.
What I don't fundamentally understand is, and this is according to DA Bragg, he asked for a lot of this material last year and didn't get it, and then Trump asks for it in January, and so far 103,000, I think, is the count. Pages of documents have been turned over. I mean, what might possibly account for that?
Well, I think one thing you have to understand is, although all of these U.S. attorneys' offices are part of the federal Department of Justice, they're prosecutorial offices working under the Department of Justice, they all enjoy a fair amount of autonomy. I mean, the Southern District of New York is also colloquially known as the Sovereign District of New York, and they take that sovereignty quite seriously. And so, yes, they don't always play well with other offices, state level prosecutions. Like, they're doing their own thing quite a lot of the time. And this may be one of those situations. I think the thing to take from all of this is that this delay is not necessarily Alvin Bragg's fault. He definitely asked for this information a year ago. It wasn't forthcoming.
Yeah.
Now it's been disclosed, and apparently it is an avalanche of documents with more to come. And he's done the right thing, which is to concede that there should be a delay. He has pushed back on the defendant's request for a 90-day delay. He's requested a 30-day delay. That's sufficient time to go through these documents. But he has prioritized the rights of this defendant to have an opportunity to review these documents against him, review the documents that may have information about those who will be testifying against him, and present the most vigorous defense that he can. And that's exactly what he should be doing.
Well, yeah. And I think he's the one saying a 30-day delay would be fine by me. Like, I could do the final today, but I could also take it in a month when I've had time to prepare for it. One of the things I don't understand, Andrew, is he makes note of the fact that the feds effectively said, we need another delay, Mr. Trump, in terms of getting you this material, repeatedly asking for extensions. All Trump wants to do is delay this thing. What would account for, I mean, first of all, they were asked for this material last year. Then they're asked for it again in January. And then they're still saying, we need more time, we need more time, we need more time. And now it's the eve of, you know, the trial beginning effectively, and they're still not done giving documents. How does that process, I mean, does that seem plausible to you? How does the process work that it might be so greatly slowed?
Well, the one thing that I don't think happened is I don't think that Main Justice was involved. It could be, but I just don't think that's the case. I agree with Melissa that U.S. Attorney's offices can, in a lot of circumstances, particularly in the Southern District of New York, just decide this on their own. That doesn't answer your question. That just sort of deals with, you know, was Merrick Garland somehow part of this? And as we've discussed, you know, I have my issues in terms of that, like the speed or lack thereof on with respect to the Attorney General. But I don't think this is something I would immediately jump to him. You know, it's hard to know how this could happen. I can tell you that my reaction and friends who either had worked in the DA's office or worked in the U.S. Attorney's office all had the same reaction, which is not something I could say on air.
on this family program?
Yeah. And because I mean, it is either just a colossal blunder or just such a wrong view in terms of the judgment call here, in terms of what needs to be done. And the idea that it so clearly took Alvin Bragg by surprise meant this normally, at the very least, if you thought you had a huge cache of documents, you would call up the DA and say, you know what, we just found, or something just happened.
Just found 100,000
documents. But it's clear that didn't happen. This was, to me, it's pretty clear there's an intention.
But that's notable, too. I think that is notable, too. Yeah. Donald Trump has been saying throughout all of these investigations and now these indictments that all of these various law enforcement officials are working in tandem. This is a collusive effort to selectively prosecute him. Like, this makes clear that that is not the case. Yeah. The Southern District of New York is not working with Alvin Bragg.
Wildly dysfunctional, not coordinating anything.
Yes. Exactly. Complete dysfunction, but certainly not the collusion that he has implied.
Not a great defense, of course.
No, not the best defense.
They're so dysfunctional that they can't be colluding. Andrew, I got to push back a little bit. I'm not suggesting that Merrick Garland was the puppeteer of, dropping 100,000 pieces of paper in Alvin Bragg's lap and Donald Trump's lap. But I do think, this is a week where Robert Hur has gone to the Hill with this highly controversial report that the White House said, that I think a lot of folks, not even just Democrats, say, was filled with just, out of school commentary about President Biden's mental acuity. The mere appointment of Robert Hur was a subject of debate. And then what he came up with seemed so, just political in nature and not to the support of the current occupant of the White House. It all serves to paint a picture of a Justice Department that seems sort of hopelessly concerned with how they're going to be perceived on the right.
So I agree with that. I'm trying to be sort of, judicious about taking each set of circumstances at the same time and looking at them to give them sort of fair weight. I agree with you with Robert. I think that is a small p political decision. I think it was done to not have criticism. So you appoint someone who's a Republican. I think that is a massive mistake. I think it buys into the idea that special counsels can act out of principle. And if you appoint Robert, that's what you get. So I think it is absolutely right to be critical of that decision. And I think it's important because I think it deals with sort of what would happen next. It's like an important milestone to say, you know what, this is what you get if you don't actually back your people in thinking that anybody, judges, prosecutors, jurors, witnesses will act out of principle. I just think in this situation, I don't know what was motivating the Southern District of New York. I just don't think they would have coordinated this. I do think Merrick Garland, he may make wrong decisions, but I do not see him trying to slow this down by saying, do not turn inculpatory information over to prosecutors and exculpatory information. The prosecutor is going to want us to know both of those and will feel like he has an obligation to turn over both of those things to the defense.
But I think to Alex's point, though, Merrick Garland should have been writing all of these prosecutors in these U.S. attorney's offices below him, like Seabiscuit, to get this done, right? I mean, so there is, I think, a failure of leadership here. I mean, just...
Right, if not
you
nefarious.
Are it doesn't have to be nefarious to be problematic. Like, he's in charge, and they report to him, this needed to be done. The defendant had a right to this information. Why did it take so long? And so, no, I agree that this may likely fall with the office, but the buck ultimately stops with Merrick Garland.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I just think the chances that Merrick Garland knew, he may have been reading it the same way we did. And of course, you're right to be like, you know what? He runs the office. Ultimately, he's totally responsible. But, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, the idea that this wouldn't be turned over, I'm pretty sure that to the extent that they didn't know at Main Justice, their reaction was probably the same as all of ours, which was, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah, you've got to be kidding is my refrain for this block of television tonight. Andrew and Melissa, please both stay with me. I have so many more questions about so many more topics. I should note that tomorrow night, this is so awesome, at 10 p.m. Eastern, Andrew and Melissa will be co-hosting a live MSNBC special on their book, The Trump Indictments. Again, that is tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on MSNBC. We have a lot more ahead tonight, including Vice President Kamala Harris and her words of warning to blue states where abortion is still legal. Be very, very concerned. But first, the judge in Donald Trump's classified documents case ruled against the former president today. But does that mean the case is going to go to trial anytime soon? That's coming up next.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
While Donald Trump has managed to delay his D.C. federal election interference case and quite likely his New York hush money case, today down in Florida, Trump was doing his best to do the same thing in his classified documents case. That's where Trump's lawyers have been arguing that the charges Trump violated in the Espionage Act, are too vague, that Trump as a former president can't be held to its standard, and that consequentially the charges should be tossed out. Judge Aileen Cannon responded a few hours later, saying that while Trump's legal team had some arguments warranting serious consideration, she would not dismiss the charges in question. Cannon did, however, leave the door open for Trump to raise the issue again in connection with jury instruction briefing and/or other appropriate motions. In other words, the proverbial can has been kicked down the proverbial road. Back with me now is Andrew Weissman. Andrew, am I reading that right? That this is Aileen Cannon just punting on this call? Yes. And what does that practically mean?
I think you have it absolutely right. And I think it's really important that people not read this as, oh, she ruled for the government. This is the worst possible decision for the government that she made today. And you're going to be like, why?
Oh,
and
yes, why?
So if she had said to the government, you know, you win. Obviously, that's great for the government. It means she thinks it's right. And then what would happen is if Trump were convicted, he could appeal that legal issue. If she had said to the government, you lose, the government gets to appeal that and go to the 11th Circuit. That's the 11th Circuit where Judge Cannon has been reversed not once, but twice. What she is trying to do is avoid at all costs doing anything that allows the government to go up to the 11th Circuit, because what can they do? They can remove her
from the case.
So this is saying, oh, I think there are serious issues that Donald Trump is raising. And I think this is really a matter of quite some concern. But you know what? I'm going to decide this later. And so it's denied without prejudice to renewal. That is, means that there's no decision. Plus, she put in the little, you know, these little, you know, bonbons of like, oh, this is a serious issue. That is really the worst possible thing for the government because they have no recourse now. And she then can just push this off. They cannot appeal it at this point.
And Trump can continue to bring it back up and slow the case down. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, that's because there's so many more motions that she can do this. The other thing, I just want to point out the irony of this idea that this is a vague statute. There are scores of people, including during the Trump presidency, who have been prosecuted for this. The indictment itself in paragraphs 23 and 24 point out Donald Trump's own statements about these laws, saying that they need to be enforced more, not less. He wanted a higher penalty for them. Now that he's a defendant, suddenly these laws are vague and no one can understand what's going on. That argument has been denied by everyone who is sitting in jail, has lost that.
Right.
This is not a vague statute. So that puts in context
how outrageous her decision is here.
Exactly. This was one where it took all day and people are like, why is this taking you all day? This is something you deny like outright. You want to hear somebody for half an hour? Fine. This is one where I really can't say it's just inexperience. I mean, just over and over again, she has shown that she is not being even-handed.
And he's making similarly meritless arguments on the Presidential Records Act.
Yes.
And saying this is, they're saying this is political persecution. And she's entertaining hearings on all of this, right?
All of it, including, you know, the favorite, which is immunity.
Yes, presidential immunity.
Which, you know, I love, because that's one where, guess what? You weren't president when this happened. And I keep on analogizing. This is a bank robber going into a bank, robbing it with a gun, shooting the guard. He's prosecuted, and he says, Judge Cannon, I cannot be prosecuted because I legally owned the gun.
Right, exactly.
And that's his argument.
She's entertaining the argument.
I can't wait for her to say these are serious issues.
Warranting serious consideration. Does it say anything to you that 2 weeks ago she held a hearing to decide on the trial date for this case? And before she's even set that, she's going through this, like, very tedious series of hearings on these poppycock motions.
I hope I am wrong, but to me, the chances that she is going to set a trial before the general election are not even infinitesimal. I just don't think that's going to happen. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I've misjudged her and that she's going to take the timeline seriously, but I just don't think that that's the case. I mean, there's still, you know, she still on the books has this May trial date. You know, there's not a single person in the world who thinks that is going to go forward. And she hasn't set a new date. And normally that's what you do as a trial judge. You need a date set in stone because you need to block out everyone's calendars. And then everyone works to that deadline. I mean,
right.
This is like real life where you say, here's the deadline, and everyone sort of manages to that time. She hasn't done that yet. So the idea that that's going to be before the general election, I hate to give everyone all this bad news.
Well, no, but it is theater. It's theater.
Yeah.
It's theater with a coward in the seat. Andrew Weissman, thank you for your time, my friend.
Nice to be here.
Mazel tov on the book.
Thank you so much.
It is an important reference in these times, my friend.
Yep.
Still ahead tonight, how South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem maybe, just maybe, increased her odds of becoming Donald Trump's running mate by indulging in the great Trumpy tradition of grift. But first, Vice President Kamala Harris visited a Minnesota Planned Parenthood today with an important message. If you want to stop Republicans from coming for abortion, IVF, and now contraception, you need to go to the ballot box in November. I'll talk to Melissa Murray and Leah Littman about that next.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
How dare these elected leaders believe they are in a better position to tell women what they need, to tell women what is in their best interest. We have to be a nation that trusts women.
Today, Vice President Kamala Harris did something no other vice president or president has ever done. She visited an abortion clinic. Harris traveled to a Planned Parenthood clinic in St. Paul, Minnesota, to highlight the stakes of the 2024 election. Even in a blue state like Minnesota, where Democrats control all the levers of state power and where reproductive freedoms are protected, a federal ban would nullify all of that. And the presumptive Republican nominee for president, whom Harris and Biden are running against, has expressed support for a nationwide ban. Democrats' bid to highlight the stakes here is only strengthened by what's happening elsewhere in the country. In Texas, basic access to contraception is now under attack. This week, a panel of appeals court judges upheld a Texas law requiring parental consent for minors to obtain contraception. And while this case might be about teens at present,
It could also signal a fight ahead. At least one Supreme Court justice has already documented his desire to overturn the right to contraception among the population at large. Joining me now is Leah Littman, professor at the University of Michigan School of Law and one of the co-hosts of the great podcast Strict Scrutiny. And back with me is Melissa Murray, the other co-host, one of the other co-hosts. We're not going to leave Kate Shaw out of Strict Scrutiny and NYU Law Professor. Leah, thank you for being here tonight. And Melissa, thank you for staying. Just don't ever leave. Leah, first, let's just talk about this Texas decision, right? Because I think there is a some people are saying, oh, but this is just affirming a kind of general parental consent decree that exists in the state of Texas. But if you read it sort of in the real world, it sounds like they're coming for contraception here.
Absolutely, because you could have said the exact same thing when they began their war on abortion access, because initially when they were attempting to restrict abortion, first they adopted laws that required parental consent for abortions, and then it was trying to enact laws that adopted additional restrictions on abortion providers, and then it was, well, how about adopting a law that requires spousal consent before obtaining abortions? And that was all part of a longer process that led to the court eventually overruling Roe versus Wade and ending the constitutional protections for abortion in Dobbs. And what we're seeing now is the beginning of the same thing happening for contraception, as Justice Thomas signaled in Dobbs that he wanted to happen more quickly than it seems like things are happening now.
It just feels like Clarence Thomas sends up a flare on like the crazy topic of his choice, and out there in the country, conservatives follow suit. I mean, do you think this is ultimately going to be, if not this case, a case about contraception is headed to the Supreme Court?
I think it is inevitable that contraception will go before the Supreme Court because, again, this isn't about simply forestalling abortion. I mean, if you wanted to end abortion, you would actually be in favor of expanding access to contraception to prevent unwanted pregnancies. It's not about abortion. It's not about preventing unwanted pregnancies. It's about controlling sexuality and, in particular, enforcing a set of gender roles on individuals like women who rely on abortion and birth control as means of controlling their reproductive capacity. And you're right. Justice Thomas is very much the intellectual genius behind this entire project. He often writes alone on the court. He did not get anyone to sign on to his concurrence in Dobbs. It doesn't matter because he has an army of former law clerks who are now sitting federal judges in places like the Fifth Circuit, who hear these flares as they go up, listen to what he's saying, read his opinions, and then put them out in their own courts as part of the law of their circuits. That's what we're seeing in the Fifth Circuit. We have seen it before in the Sixth Circuit. Justice Thomas has been shepherding this completely bogus narrative that abortion is linked to the eugenics movement and has been used as a tool to deracinate the African-American community. No one else signed on to his concurrence in an opinion saying that, but then it began appearing in lower courts opinions, and then it appeared in a footnote in Dobbs. So he is the sort of evil genius behind all of this. And when he's done for the night, he goes back to his office and strokes a hairless cat and prides himself on what he has done.
Talks about the end of bodily autonomy as we know it in this country. Leah, can you talk a little bit about Jonathan Mitchell, who is involved in this case, and Matthew Kaczmarek, the judge whose name may be familiar to some viewers of this program because we talk about him a lot. He's done a great and inordinate amount of work in terms of furthering the conservative agenda through the courts.
Yeah, so he's a busy guy. He was the judge in the medication abortion case that the Supreme Court, the Mifepristone case that the court is going to be hearing in a few weeks. He's a judge who effectively ordered a nationwide ban on medication abortion, one of the drugs used in the medication abortion protocol. He is also the judge in the Title X contraception case. He is also the judge where there was a multi-million dollar lawsuit filed against Planned Parenthood in his court. And they are filing these cases before him, you know, in particular his division, because they know, based on his track record, he was essentially appointed to do all of the things he's doing now, right? Making it more difficult to actually make medication abortion access available, now restricting access to contraception, and just outlining all of these theories that then some judges on the Fifth Circuit pick up on, and then they go up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is able to steadily move the law in a more conservative direction, even if they don't do everything that Judge Kaczmarek does, even if they don't do everything that Jonathan Mitchell asks them to do, they are still steadily moving the law away from access to contraception, access to reproductive freedom, access to bodily autonomy. And so that is, again, what Judge Kaczmarek was put on the bench to do, and that is what he is doing.
And Jonathan Mitchell is the guy that came up with the bounty hunter abortion law in Texas, right?
I mean, he is a busy guy. The bounty hunter abortion law in Texas, SB 8, which the Supreme Court allowed to go into effect well before Dobbs, essentially ending abortion access in the second largest state in the union before Dobbs did, a precursor of things to come. He was also the lawyer who argued the disqualification appeal before the United States Supreme Court for Donald Trump. And, you know, we've talked about
the 14th
this on our
Amendment,
podcast.
The 14th yes, Amendment the case.
We've talked about this endlessly on our podcast. We think he's auditioning to be our next attorney general.
Yeah, well, he has basically made statements, right, to the press indicating that he wants in the next Trump administration, the administration to begin enforcing the Comstock Act, a Victorian-era law from the 1870s that, you know, now more than 100 Republicans have signed onto a brief that they say allows them to ban medication abortion without actually having to pass a new law. This is a theory that Jonathan Mitchell says, let's not talk about until after the election.
Well, and he's great at these kind of end runs around what the right. law says,
you
right?
know, he's great around these end runs around majoritarian preferences because they realize there is unlikely to be majoritarian support for a national ban on abortion. So even if they are able to get control of Congress and the presidency, there would be considerable pushback. But all they need to enforce the Comstock Act is a Republican president with a Department of Justice willing to prioritize this as an enforcement priority. And they're in business. They will resuscitate this zombie law and they will begin enforcing it, preventing the shipment and interstate commerce of any article that might be used for abortion. And that includes long-acting forms of contraception that they term abortifacients.
Well, I mean, and this is coming as they're talking about litigating, well, they are litigating IVF, right?
Yes.
Once you have sort of allowed Christian nationalism to sort of infuse your party platform to the degree that all interference with contraception, which is where life begins, should be unlawful and is unethical, then that sort of dictates what your party priorities are in terms of policy, Leah.
Yes, no, they have opened the door to this because once you start saying states have a legitimate interest in just treating fetuses, unviable fetuses as potential human beings, then that doesn't end with abortion. It extends to contraception, it extends to IVF, it extends to all other manners of reproductive health care. And so that's happening with the Alabama Supreme Court decision. And honestly, this was happening even before Dobbs. You know, Melissa mentioned treating contraception as abortifacients. The Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby versus Burwell essentially said that some employers were entitled to believe
yep.
and then act on their belief that some forms of contraception were abortifacients and therefore did not have to offer that form of health insurance coverage to their employees. So the seeds have already been planted and they are just waiting again for the next Republican president, knowing that the Republican Supreme Court will let them get away with basically anything to test the limits of the law and try to bring a federal abortion ban to life without having to enact it into law.
That's why Kamala Harris was in Minnesota today. You could be in a blue state with Democrats controlling the state, have all the protections you think you need, but it matters who's sitting in the White House. Leah Littman and Melissa Murray, thank you for this chariot ride into darkness. I appreciate your time. Still ahead tonight, would you be interested in purchasing a Donald Trump NFT? How about some gold sneakers? What about a brand new smile? Donald Trump and Kristi Noem, sure hope you're interested. I'll discuss Governor Noem's new contributions to the great MAGA grift next. When Donald Trump became the Republican nominee for president in 2016, his daughter Ivanka spoke at the Republican National Convention. The next morning, she tweeted this. Shop Ivanka's look from her hashtag RNC speech with a link to Ivanka's clothing line. After Trump was elected, the Trump family sat down for an interview with 60 Minutes. Afterward, Ivanka, then a member of the Trump transition team, sent an email urging people to purchase the Ivanka Trump branded bracelet that she wore in that interview. Shortly after Trump took office, Kellyanne Conway, a senior White House advisor, went on Fox News.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell you. I'm going to go get some on myself today. It's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
That free commercial was actually a big scandal. The Office of Government Ethics found that Kellyanne Conway violated federal standards of conduct. The chair of the House Oversight Committee at the time, Republican Jason Chaffetz, who is now a Fox News personality, this is what he said about Kellyanne Conway's commercial.
When Kellyanne Conway said what she said about buying that particular product, that was wrong, wrong, wrong. I called it out.
There are a lot of ways in which Donald Trump and his family have sought to profit off the presidency. But using one's candidacy and subsequent office to sell goods and services is a uniquely Trumpy innovation. Now, Trump has kept all of this up in his current candidacy by hawking everything from digital trading cards to really appalling Trump-branded gold sneakers. And now other Republicans want in on that game.
Well, hi, I'm Christine Noem. I'm the governor of South Dakota and had the opportunity to come to Smile, Texas to fix my teeth, which has been absolutely amazing. I chose the team here at Smile, Texas because they're the best. It has been a gift to be here at Smile, Texas.
That was Christine Noem, the current Republican governor of South Dakota, doing what might best be described as a 5-minute infomercial for a Texas-based cosmetic dentistry company. Apart from being creepy and a total affront to South Dakota's dental industry, that video may also have been illegal. Yesterday, the consumer protection group Travelers United sued Governor Noem for potentially violating consumer protection law by failing to label the video as a paid advertisement. It is a remarkable thing for any politician to do, but especially for someone like Governor Noem, who's widely considered to be on Trump's vice presidential shortlist. But then again, maybe that's the point. What better way to show you're ready to be part of Team Trump than jumping in on the grift? I'll talk with Roger Sullenberger of the Daily Beast about the Republican Party's snake oil problem coming up next. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem was among the many Republican officials who attended President Biden's inauguration back in January of 2021. She even congratulated Biden in a post online. Congratulations to President Biden and Vice President Harris on your inauguration today. And then she tried to sell some gloves. Thankful for my at Sitka Gear gloves. Use discount code Noem for 15% off. It was an unusual congratulations, especially considering Sitka Gear is not even from the governor's home state. It's a Montana-based company. We may never know why exactly Governor Noem chose to spotlight her gloves at a presidential inauguration or why this week she posted a 5-minute infomercial for a cosmetic dentistry company based in Texas, but we sure have a good idea. The governor should feel right at home in a Republican Party that loves the grift and learned it best from their party leader, Donald Trump. Joining me now is Roger Sullenberger, senior national political reporter at the Daily Beast. Roger, thanks for being here. What did the Smile Texas video that the governor posted say to you?
Well, I think you covered it pretty well. A Democratic legislator in South Dakota has introduced, a motion to see if, you know, a call for investigation to see if there were some ethical violations here on her part, right? Using her office for personal gain. We don't know, like, using this like promotive, platform. But what's really fascinating about this is, like, not that long ago, Kristi Noem actually acted as a dentist in a PSA that she, like, I think it was last year, she did as part of a workforce recruitment sort of campaign to bring more dentists to South Dakota. She's passed legislation to make it easier to be a dental, to make it easier to be a dental hygienist in South Dakota. So, you know, in addition to the ethics, you know, the ethical questions, you have to wonder if this is sort of a confession that her own programs have not really borne fruit yet.
Well, you would think there would be maybe some fallout, not just because of the ethical breaches, but, you know, just purely on a sort of Chamber of Commerce level. She's advocating for people to go to Texas to get their smiles fixed. I mean, that is the thing that I think is most staggering, is the way that there is no shame in the game, quite literally, in the age of Trump.
Yeah, no shame. And again, like, it is all because they're following the lead of Donald Trump since the, you know, since the drop, right? Since 2015, when he launched into this, you know, like, it was a promotional campaign. I think now that, you know, we're seeing that in a sort of systemic way, right? With the RNC sort of welding itself to the Trump campaign, just today, actually, they launched their joint fundraising apparatus for 2024 with the RNC, which allows mega donors to cut like an $800,000 check to this one committee. And then through a series of transactions, that money, not fully $800,000, but hundreds of thousands of dollars from each of those donations, and, you know, all told millions of dollars, can be routed back to the RNC through this setup into its legal account, right? Which can then be used to pay Donald Trump's legal bills. They just launch that today. And if you want to read about how that works, you can check out my paydirt newsletter in the Daily Beast.
Well, I mean, the grift and then the sort of collusion between big moneyed interests and the Republican Party in an official capacity is appalling. I would recommend everybody read your piece today. Roger Sullenberger with the Daily Beast. Thank you again for your time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Alex.
That is our show for this evening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.